Welcome to the Paper Club Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Rafael Herrera, and with me as always is my delightful co-host, Marcia Olivaida.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Raf. How are you?
I'm doing all right. She is a lead scientist at Deeper Insights. As usual, every month, we invite a Deeper Insights expert to the show to highlight and discuss an academic paper from the data science literature. And this month, our guest is computer vision senior data scientist, Dr. Caterina Carvalho.
Wonderful, Raf. Thank you.
Did I actually do that right?
Yes, that was good.
All right. Go me. She has a PhD in computer vision and is our computer vision expert. She's fantastic. But we also have special occasion this time. We have a bonus guest this month. This bonus guest is our generative AI ambassador. She's a data scientist here, and that is Sonia Marks. How you doing?
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much.
No problem. I'm so happy to have such a full room of brilliant people here today. So even though we're not in the same room, that's the magic of this podcast. So thank you all for showing up. I'm really looking forward to discussing this month's paper. And Caterina, go ahead and tell us, what is this paper and what are we talking about today?
Thank you for the kind introduction, Raf. So today we are going to discuss high-resolution image synthesis with latent diffusion models by Robin Rombach, Andreas Botman, Dominique Lawrence, Patrick Esser, and Bjorn Omer. And this is the seminal work behind what almost everybody knows, stable diffusion. So we are going to go through it in a bit of detail. And this is very interesting because it allows to do a bunch of things.
Yeah. It sounds like really interesting stuff. I hear about stable diffusion maybe 5 times a day. Maybe it's just because I work at an AI company. But either way, it's still everywhere. Almost as popular as ChatGPT, but not yet. Probably a little bit harder to access. So, Caterina, let's jump right in. Why did you choose this paper in particular?
Nowadays, if we want to do computer vision and generative AI, what else should we look at first that other than stable diffusion? So that was the reasoning. We have this very kind interest on generative AI, and that's the main reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's pivotal stuff right now. Sonia, how did you find the paper?
Yeah, it's so interesting. As the main contributions that I'll be explored a bit more later, I think this adds on the diffusion models in general,
okay.
The stable diffusion type of architecture that makes the model so much more efficient that I think the social impact that it has on the research field is that it makes it much more accessible to everyone to work with. And that's something that we really want to strive for in the research area. So to not make only huge corporations be able to work on this, but also smaller companies that have great minds to explore this generative AI field, also access this area and this potential.
One of the main differences is that stable diffusion, perhaps this is obvious for all of us, but not for the listeners, is an open source alternative to well-known text-to-image generators like DALL-E was released by OpenAI. And this is like a Midjourney as well.
My favorite.
Raf's favorite, which is also not open source. So one of the differences is that stable diffusion is open source.
I think that makes it a little bit more democratized. I think people could just dig right in and start playing with it. I know even I, as a non-data scientist, I only play one on the podcast. I'm not really a data scientist, but even I was able to tinker with it a little bit until I found it too difficult for myself and my computer, because apparently you need a lot of power behind that computer. And then I just switched to Midjourney, which is much easier. But back to the task at hand, let's talk about this paper. What do you believe the main contributions of the paper are? Because it sounds like it's obvious image generation with text prompting is a big deal, but how did we get there? What's the magic sauce in all of that?
So that's a very good question. Let me just, before, clear out a bit of the applications that this type of that this paper allowed in line as well as with models such as DALL-E. But so stable diffusion can be used. Their most commonly known application is text to image. So you write a prompt and then you get this interesting image as output. but it can also be used to generate synthetic data. And for deeper insights, that's one of the key points of using this type of generative AI. So we can, for instance, generate different places, we can generate different scenes, we can also generate different images. For instance, there's this Celeb A data set, and that powers, that has the potential to power our training processes. So some of the struggle is that our clients may not have as much data as we need, and those type of architectures, these type of models can be used to generate synthetic data that can be used to train our models. The main contributions, as Sonia also has mentioned at the beginning, from like this stable diffusion or latent space diffusion models, is that it allowed the reduction of complexity, because instead of working on the image space with this massive convolutional neural networks, we are working on the so-called latent space. And an easy understanding on the latent space is like the minimum amount of important features that can be used to represent an image. So it's a much more compressed representation of, for instance, a picture. It can even be represented up to like 2 or 4 values only. So impressive, the capacity of these latent space models. So it reduces the need for high computational power. At the same time, it allows to generate a higher variability of images with more complexity in opposition to GANs. So I believe the main contribution of this paper is to combine very different understandings from physics, so Markov chain, with diffusion models, and associating it with transformers for the prompts. So it just brings a lot of research together, and that's the power of research.
That sounds real fancy. A lot of stuff going on. So it sounds like you're really just combining a variety of different technologies, disciplines, and academic thought to create a picture of a kitty cat drinking coffee. You know, I mean, that's really
true.
Yeah, I think something that is very interesting in this generative AI field is that it's becoming more and more multimodal. Like when we started this generative AI ambassador thing in Deeper Insights, we tried to divide the tasks by vision and natural language processing. And now that is becoming increasingly difficult because everything is coming together, all the different modalities of data, and in the architectures and models and the methodologies that are usually specific to one another, they are coming together as one to build this massive, very flexible, and with a lot of potential, these new models that are coming.
And actually, if I can add a quick point here, for any of you that might be listening and didn't know, our Deeper Insights Generative AI Ambassadors, Sonia and
Leticia Fernandez.
Leticia. Both of them are basically the main hunters of this knowledge, of all of these disciplines. They're out there in the world scouring the internet, trying to give us as much information on this, educating themselves to the highest levels. So they are our in-house experts, so we're really happy to have them. Thank you very much for doing all that work. But obviously, we have a lot more to cover. So what else were you going to add there, Katerina? I'm sorry, I cut you off there.
No, I was just going to comment on the multimodal nature of these approaches.
Yes, please do.
It's so important. I did my PhD and postdoc on the biomedical field, and there we saw the need of combining this type of different data. For instance, we did diagnosis on images, and we were trying to compare ourselves or the model against doctors. But doctors have much more information. They have like the demographics, they have the results of blood sampling, they have all this extra textual information that was not being used at the time for like a computer-aided diagnosis model. So, and this was like maybe 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it was not so long, but the increase in how powerful these models are and the introduction of these different technologies is crucial for a more complete diagnosis. In this case, combining text, getting images, getting text out of images, and vice versa. So it's so interesting.
So my question is then, how do researchers validate the accuracy and effectiveness of these models? And what are some common metrics they use to measure this, the performance of these generative models? Because it doesn't seem very straightforward, right?
Yes, you are very right. Because these type of diffusion models or latent diffusion models, they work a lot with the concept of noise. And for us humans, noise is something that we do not want to have in the process. So we are always trying to get rid of noise. In these models, they do impose noise as a way of having robust feature estimation and to have robust and variation. Also, as we were discussing before, these, if you use stable diffusion and if you like write a picture of a cat drinking a coffee, if you run it one time, it will get something. If you run it a second time, it will get something else. And even though it's not clear what powers this type of randomness, it's introducing noise into the process. So in this paper, the authors introduced a new loss function that is used to train. So it's called perceptual loss. And in essence, is trying to match the levels of noise that are predicted and that are introduced at the beginning of the process. So saying it in an easier way, these type of networks work on trying to predict noise as best as they can. And in the meanwhile, they have this all crazy and interesting output, so you can generate new data. So noise is almost like the power behind these models.
I think something that is also very crucial in assessing the effectiveness of these models is also having human feedback. Because, for example, with GANs, which are a different type of architecture, it's they have the generator and the discriminator part, and the discriminator's job is to evaluate how real an image looks. So they have that like integrated in the architecture. In this case, it's a very different type of method, and I think it's very crucial to have in the assessment part, in the evaluation part, to have an actual human validating how real the images are, and if these outputs can really fool a human into thinking they were like painted or they were an actual photograph of the scene. Yeah, I think that's a very very straightforward way to assess these models.
And that makes sense. Computer's not really going to know anything. Obviously, we have to tell it that it's right. No, that is a kitten. No, that's a tiger. No, that's a dragon. And that's not even coffee. That's tea. So yeah, somebody has to step in and make that clear, it seems like.
Yeah, I agree that taking this human feedback is very important because this will be ultimately used by humans. So it's important that it's doing what humans expect it to do. But this leads me to my next question, because there are some limitations as well of these models and some criticisms and shortcomings.
This type of technology can be used for good or it can be used for bad. If incorrectly used, this type of technology, for instance, can be used to generate, to manipulate data. There's a very well-known case or type of work, the deepfakes. So you can get someone well-known saying something and that was never done by that person. So you can manipulate data in order to look like what you want it to look like. So it can be used for misinformation and all these bad things. From a more technical perspective, it's still limited. So a picture of a cat drinking coffee will not be as realistic as one could be. So maybe I did not choose the right
example. I chose that. That's my problem. But you know what? I just wanted to see a cat drinking coffee. So.
Yes. So there's still some limitations on the high resolution, generating high resolution images. Me personally, I'm very bad at creating prompts. So when I try a stable diffusion, I always get these maybe like six fingers. So things can be a bit strange, but that's totally on me. That's totally on me. And so nowadays, it's also a very big concern. So bias on these AI models, these type of generative AI, they do learn from their training data set. And so depending on the distribution, gender, race, all these type of considerations, depending on the distribution of your training data set, the model can be very biased. And so that's also a very important consideration for generative AI overall.
And I think just to add, there's some also ethical limitations or considerations to be done in terms of copyright, because I think, I don't know if Katarina mentioned before, but the fact that they can use the training data can by mistake be outputted by the model as is, or very close to the original training data. And in essence, like applications like DALL-E or Stable Diffusion, you own the things that you prompt. So this can lead to very tricky situations in which artists get the bad hand of the situation, because their work is being used without their consent or their explicit consent, taken from the internet and used to train these models. And then someone prompts it. I'm not saying that prompting is an easy job. It's very tricky, but it doesn't require the skill and the training that these artists have. And they have access to creating amazing pieces of art with their skills. And I think that's a bit unfair. So maybe legislation needs to go as fast as technology goes.
It never does.
Which is at a very, very rapid speed. Yeah, it's not easy. And it's a very tricky situation because we don't want to constrain these advances in technology. But on the other hand, we also need to take into consideration the work of the people that actually produce the training data. And they don't have a word in the use of that.
That makes a lot of sense. These artists work many, many years, decades, who knows, getting themselves skilled, developing a style that's really unique to them. And now we can all do it. And there is something.
The style part is so tricky because, you can literally copy the work of some big artist. It's not as good, probably, at least with the current technology, but in a few years it will. And that can be really unfair.
No, I agree.
I totally agree with the copyright concerns. But to understand this better, let us understand as well, what are the real world applications of these kind of generative models like Stable Diffusion? Because there's these shortcomings, but there's also some benefit we can get from these models, and kind of understanding a bit these applications can help shed light on this.
Yeah. So I'll start from a more academic approach and then dive potentially in some use cases that we could do at Deeper Insights. So how can we leverage this type of technology? So as I said at the beginning, this is very well known for text to image, and it is commonly used to generate artificial art. So there's several applications, RAF, you know and use some of them, but that's, so for art, for generating art, it's very used. Then on a more, continuing on the technical side, we can also, and it's fascinating, for instance, draw a picture of our living room. So like a basic draw with the couch and table and the TV, and feed that into these type of models, and the model will generate a realistic representation of your living room based on that layout with real couch and real TV. And that can be used for like interior design, or at least in a cheap way to generate a realistic representation of what it's on the person's mind. So I think this type of technology can easily translate what we are thinking or what text into something that it's real. And that's very cool. Another application is like in painting. And you know, those pictures that you take, there's a sunset and then it's like awesome. And then when you take the picture, there's like a person walking the dog right in front of it.
Always a person. It's so annoying.
Yes, there's always a person. This person's stealing your sunset. So in painting can be used to remove unknown, like the figure of a person, for instance, the figure of a a tree in front of a building. So it can be used to remove unwanted information, and these models can know how to generate it. It looks like magic, but they know how to generate what is behind that object, and that's super cool.
One that I find very interesting and very benign use of AI is the image denoising and restoration. And it comes a bit related to in painting. So if you have an old photograph of your grandparents and the photograph is a bit corrupted in some area, you can use these technologies not only to make the resolution of the photograph higher, but also to fix those issues and make like a very pretty picture that wouldn't be possible to be taken at the time.
Right.
And
gets rid of all the dust and the tears and everything that would
The nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Something that can also be done in academic use is depth estimation. So in this image to image applications of these diffusion models, you can train it to estimate the depth of each pixel of the image, and that can be very useful in multiple applications. Also, optical flow. That's basically optical flow is the estimation of the pattern of movement in a sequence of images, and that can be useful, for instance, in a car when you want to follow the movement of a certain object in a video. These models can be used to do that tracking. That's very, very interesting as well.
This leads me to a little bit in the paper. There's a lot of talk about how these images are developed by noise, right? So, and probability. And I think that's the thing that kind of stuck out in my head, the idea of probability. So it's essentially when you are in painting or something like you were talking about earlier, you're guessing to, okay, well, this is happening and I'm guessing through probability and training what is behind that. So could you just give me a little bit of understanding on how that works a little bit?
I'll try. So maybe with the easy example, you know, when you are a kid at school and you draw a house, there's always like one door, two windows, one chimney.
Sure.
So there is a pattern that it's common to specific structures. So a dog will always have, well, we'll have four legs, 2 ears. So there, what the model does is like abstract from that specific dog, from that specific house, and learn that there's like this common representation. For instance, if we have the sunset, the model will have learned from thousands and millions of sunset images, how is it probable to look like on the place that the person is covering, like the sky for real. So according to these things that we know happen all the time, these sunset pictures, probably the background, if we remove this person, the background will look like a specific, it will have a specific gradient. It will be based on the time of the day that corresponds, like it's yellower, is it a whiter? So it will learn from the things that it has seen before. It will learn from this pattern. We have to take a few steps back and look. The house will always have two windows, one door. The sunset will have this gradient. So, and the model learns those patterns and it's able to probably estimate what's behind.
Oh, wow. Okay. To make it match the original image, then it just kind of fuses it with that as well, like adds that to the probability or what? Because I mean, there are so many sunsets and I want to get rid of one annoying person that walked by and he's there. It could give you a different idea of what a sunset is in just the outline of that person. So how does it blend it? You know, like it, so it just uses all that.
When it comes to that type of task within painting or image restoration, there's a very crucial task that is integrated in these models, which is conditioning. So the input is not only the noise or in the like, distribution of probabilities of the data that you trained it with, but there's always that also that specific case, that image that is used as input to within that distribution, make it conditioned so it matches the point of the distribution in which that image is, and it completes the missing part.
It's almost like you have a puzzle, and somebody's just deciding, all right, well, it's a puzzle of just the color blue. Let's look at all these pieces that are over here. Which one's blue? Which one's fit? And then slowly narrows it down. Like, well, you know what? This one probably work really well. And then boom.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy.
Yeah? All right. That's, I can't wait to start using that. Like, I'm going to get rid of so many people from all of my photos and videos. The only one that visited any amazing landmark ever.
So yes, you can remove tourists from your touristy photos. You can just remove everybody, and it's like
we'll just revisit all our best pictures from 2015 vacation in Paris.
I could add more smiles
and remove ex-boyfriends as well. I'm just kidding.
Oh yeah, you know that is definitely an application I did not consider, but that's a very good point.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, that is brilliant. Do we have any other last-minute points that we want to make before we wrap the show up this month?
Yes, so I still see two type of maybe more practical use cases for using this type of generative AI, and these are two levels. So the first one is typically computer vision projects always require a lot of data, and sometimes people don't have as much data as they wanted, so generative AI can be used to synthesize data that can be explored for like initial projects. So we can augment our training data set using these type of technologies. And secondly, once we have a good, of course, taking care that synthetic data is not the same as real data. So always those considerations. So, but after that type of like initial project, even if there is a large data set, these type of approaches can be used to further augment it and to drive performance. So more than just like a test or experiment with a small data set, this can actually impact training performance. And we have seen at the company that even though our training data set is like of lower quality, it does improve training performance. So having more data sets, having larger image sets, it can improve performance during training.
Wow. So essentially what you're saying is you can use AI to build more AI that's stronger and more accurate.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy. It's so easy for the robots to take over, let me tell you. Wow.
That's why you should be kind to them.
That's right. Whenever you chat, always say
please and thank you.
Uh-huh. No, that's a very good lesson. Sonia, any last words on the topic of Stable Diffusion, this amazing paper? Apparently it's a seminal one, another one.
What made me more, made me like this paper so much was that thing that I mentioned in the beginning, the democratizing the technology in some sense. I really find that these models are getting more bigger and bigger and more complex, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for small research companies or just individual researchers to explore these technologies by themselves because they're very costly, very time consuming, and require a lot of data. So anything that makes these technologies more available to everyone is always a step in the good direction, in my opinion.
No, that sounds good to me. I think that's an excellent place to stop. I think we nailed it. We were officially all experts now for having listened to this. So I thank all of you real experts for helping me get there. And obviously all of our listeners, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more information coming out about everything generative AI. It feels like every single day there's something new, something magical, a new model of this, a new model of that. So I'm sure we'll have you all back on for another show down the line. So thank you for joining us on the show, and a special thank you to our guests, Sonia and Katerina. A thank you to my co-host, Marcia. Always great to have you on board. And to our listeners, if you like discussing data science, academic papers like these, about all this new and amazing technology that's coming out, please feel free to subscribe to our feed. We are be releasing these every month, and we're going to have new guests, all kinds of fun stuff going on. It's always very exciting. If you could just see the room, we're all dancing. We're all excited about this amazing stuff. So please join us and feel free to subscribe, as I said. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us at thepaperclub@deeperinsights.com. And until next month, I am Raphael, and I'm here with Sonia, Marcia, Katerina, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.